Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by listeners like you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And here we are, sort of, a little theme has developed here, and that might be, well, we'll see next week if it becomes a theme that's developed, but here we have our second in a row of sandwiches. And you know, historians often study a culture through the lens of its food and foodways, and sandwiches are somehow very approachable for this study in these last couple of shows. But it's rare, in fact, that one particular food or dish persists so dynamically, one could say tenaciously, through a culture's economic struggles and political strife and emigration, and takes on a life of its own in another country. In fact, in this case, globally. So it has been with the Cuban sandwich. Yet, very few can agree on what the origins were of this iconic sandwich. And fortunately, my guests, and along with a couple other authors, have written a new book that explains these origins, or at least attempts to, and some of the deeper meanings of the history. According to them, the history lies between the layers. My guest today is Andrew Hughes, curator of Florida Studies at University of Florida, University of South Florida, libraries. And he's the author of From Saloons to Steakhouses, A History of Tampa. And along with him, Barbara Cruz, a professor at University of South Florida as well. She's a professor of social science, and Jeff Hoke, who is a marketing and restaurant group food writer and blogger. And they are all living right now in Tampa, so I don't let you know that ahead of time. They might be skewed on who has the best sandwich. We'll see. But we'll hear that directly from the author himself, Andy. Andy, welcome so much to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Linda. It's great to be here.
Upon first glance, it's a slim book. It's not, you know, doesn't look like this huge tome of years and years of history. And yet, once you get into it, the book, I didn't say the name of the book again. I do that often. And that is The Cuban Sandwich, A History in Layers. Pretty much described that in the beginning. But this book is just packed full of history. Recipes, background on people who have been making the sandwich for a long time, takes on your hypotheses of what the origins were, and along with some, you know, good research to back it up. But why don't you tell me what drove you to write this book, and how, and what you feel the history is of this sandwich in light of Cuban cuisine in total.
Yeah, well, like you said, I live in Tampa, and I really became enamored with Tampa's history, and fell in love with the history here, the immigrant groups, and the Cuban history, and kind of, you know, got interested in all that stuff, and was really interested as a graduate student in sort of documenting the history of Tampa in a different way. And I really felt like that the food had been neglected, especially by scholars, and that, you know, a lot of attention had been paid to cigar workers and lots of other really great and fascinating stuff. But I felt like this was something that was really had been neglected. And none of my colleagues at the time, this is in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, no one was really looking in that direction at the time. And the Food Network was just kind of breaking. So, I became really interested in the history there. And I ended up talking to people about the Cuban sandwich and, of course, trying it for myself. And, I heard a lot of people grumble that, oh, Miami gets all the attention about the Cuban sandwich. And at one point, I wrote an article in a local magazine that sort of got picked up by the Southern Foodways Alliance, and it got reprinted in their Cornbread Nation when they were still doing those kind of best of Southern food writings. And anyway, and it was sort of a little polemic about how Tampa had been left out of the equation, you know, especially in the 80s and the 90s. You know, if people talked about Cuban sandwiches, it was, you know, they just went straight to Miami. And, you know, the general narrative was that the Cuban sandwich arrived sometime in the early 60s or the late 50s with all the people that fled Castro. But it kind of left out, a whole century of history that was happening before that, and generations of Cubans who had come before. So, you know, I was never one to argue necessarily that the Cuban sandwich was invented in Tampa. There's a lot of people here that like to believe that. But at the same time, I felt like it had still been left out. So long story short, that article sort of made me the only expert or the only person who had, you know, done much writing or research specifically about the sandwich, you know, at least outside of, you know, a couple newspaper writers. So eventually people just started calling me, you know, asking if they're writing an article about the Cuban sandwich, asking for information. And I'm a librarian and an archivist by trade, so I help people do research. And after years of this, you know, after a while, I started telling myself, I really need to write something just to answer these questions. And of course, it is, you know, it's something fun to talk about. Part of my theory about the popularity of the sandwich is it's simply fun to say, you know. And if you were someone, say, 100 years ago, and no one else had heard of this thing, and you'd say, have you tried a Cuban sandwich? You know, it's got all kinds of stuff in it. So I think that's part of the appeal, you know. So that kind of tells you how I arrived at it, because I felt like, in a way, the subject sort of chose me. And of course, you know, I've always been really interested in eating Cuban sandwiches, but it's at one point around 2000 or so in the late 90s, I sort of, I don't know, I felt like nobody was trying very, you know, people weren't trying very hard typically. And I'm happy to report I see that changing too.
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a whole, I think in general, there's a whole, you know, new focus on food in particular,
right.
Particularly people's, that what they identify food with, what it means to them. And if there is something that is, you know, that you're well known for doing, people are super, you know, doing a super great job paying attention to it. And I have to say that I really didn't know that much at all about the Cuban sandwich. And so I went down to Miami in the early 90s. I said, I got to have one. I got to have what everyone's talking about. And this was very early 90s. Yeah. A Cuban sandwich. So someone said, well, yeah, you go down to this stretch here and you go into, you know, up this little window. You can really order it right from the window. I was so disappointed. You know, not all Cuban sandwiches are equal, as you will tell us. Right. And so then over the years, I have just been, you know, so excited and thrilled to see all the attention that it's gotten and on menus all over the place. And I live in New York. So in New York, suddenly it's, you can find it in just about every sandwich place. I mean, there's always going to be a version of a Cuban. And that was, I think that's terrific. But you keep saying about Miami and, you know, Tampa and was it, you know, invented there, but surely it goes back further than that. As you said, what can you tell me about the actual history of of the sandwich in terms of when it, what it is. What is it first for those right. who are uninitiated?
Okay. Well, it depends on when and where and who you are, you know, of what's in it. But in general, it's been sort of standardized at this point. So the Miami version is, you know, Cuban bread with a ham and roast pork, pickles, Swiss cheese and mustard.
Right.
And then, you know, Tampa's version typically adds salami. And then, you know, as you go farther back, it becomes more and more amorphous. So you have all kinds of different combinations that are happening in Cuba, across the United States, et cetera. So it really was sort of a blank canvas in some respects. Typically, you'd start with ham and pork and then augment it from there.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's interesting because you're in the book, the description of the sandwich and its origins in Cuba, what came as a sandwich made of very, I don't want to say exotic ingredients, but, it, you know, not your quotidian kind of sandwich filling. I mean, these were a lot of imported items, like Swiss cheese and, you know, and some of the other things. What, do you have any leads on that as to how that all came about?
Yeah, well, in Cuba, of course, sort of the gateway to the New World for, you know, a long time, ever since mm-hmm. it had been colonized by the Spanish. So it's sort of a waypoint for, and then also you've got lots and lots of immigrants who are living, especially in Havana. You know, it was known as a very cosmopolitan city in the 1800s. So you've got people from all over the world who are living there, doing business there, et cetera. And so all those, you know, different influences were really felt in Cuba, and especially, you know, kind of well-to-do Cubans were really interested in what kind of the latest fads were and everything. So they took a lot of cues from Havana, from New York City, and from other places. But I'd say Havana and New York were the two really leading lights in as far as like influences. So, you know, so the like Cuban bread, for example, is deeply influenced by like Spanish barra bread, as well as, you know, as well as French bread. French bread was very popular in Cuba. You know, but then, you know, you mentioned imports too, and that's really important. So, you know, you got the steamship is really becoming standardized in the mid 1800s. And by the late 1800s, you start to have like refrigerated shipping. So that means that the island of Cuba, suddenly there's all kinds of imports that weren't available before.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, all kinds of processed meats. And so that was, you know, a big deal. And you can just see it in the Cuban newspapers, you know, where Armour and Swift and other meat packers are starting to have, you know, more, more ads in the newspapers about, you know, all their different products and marketing products specifically, you know, to Cubans.
Yeah. And, you know, prior to that, the country was just constantly being riddled by, you know, getting caught in the middle of political battles and right. people wanting to control them. Right. So they were always fighting for their freedom and independence. And I thought that your description of Cubans using trying to separate, well, obviously wanting their independence from Spain, wanting to separate themselves and show their individual identities. And often they did that through the food, often, which, you know, right. dishes that were really Cuban and not Spanish. Oh, that's a Spanish dish. I mean, it's in Spanish. It must be a Spanish dish. And yet they would say, no, this is Cuban and with the Cuban flavors. That carried over to the sandwich as well, I think, right?
Yeah, well, at the time that, you know, in the kind of era that the sandwich was born in, you know, you start to see, like in the mid 1800s, you know, there's this real push for independence or at least autonomy within the Spanish Empire.
Right.
And, you know, and part of that kind of making of a new nation was to, you know, to distinguish themselves through their food. So, you know, anything criollo, anything Creole was exalted as more Cuban, you know, and more, you know, fundamental to their identity. So like ajiaco, the stew that goes back to the earliest days of the colony, that was, you know, considered like one of the bedrocks of Cuban identity, you know. And even Fernando Ortiz, you know, a really notable anthropologist from Cuba, you know, he talked about it as, yeah, being the bedrock of identity. You know, it had influences from, you know, the chilies from Native Americans. It had the meat, typically beef or pork, from the Spanish. And then you've got the slave foods, you know, root vegetables that are associated with slave food. So you put those three things together and you've got Cuba in a pot. So
Interesting, Cuba in a pot.
And this idea, of course, that also that an ajiaco, it could simmer for weeks and you could just keep adding ingredients, you know, as long as you keep cooking it, right? And this idea that it's never quite finished, kind of like Cuba, you know, it's always simmering. There's always something new being included. But then also it's like this, it's similar to the melting pot analogy, except that the pieces of in the ingredients that go into an ajiaco don't disappear. They don't melt. Mm-hmm. They become suffused by the other ingredients and they offer their own flavors into the pot. But it's a much more, I think, compelling, you know, metaphor for a country, an ajiaco.
Yeah. I love that. About the fact that, like Cuba, it's never done. And I can just see the simmering pot of stew, you know, just keep adding, oh, you know, the cousins are coming, add more beef, you know, add more peppers. You know, it's like,
right.
That's great. I like that. When the sandwich, well, even before that, there were you talked about the country being this political strife from, you know, between the sugar market and the slave market and to Cold War being trapped and controlled by other countries. So how is a sandwich representative or is a metaphor for this, you know, this struggle to, for independence?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it. So, you know, first of all, I think that Cubans were, you know, they wanted a new identity, and ajiaco was an example of the old colonial identity. Now, while they considered it thoroughly Cuban, it was old Cuba, you know, and they think they wanted dishes that were going to represent new Cuba. Now, I don't think people were necessarily thinking this out loud, you know, but yeah. They, as you're aspiring to a nation, you want to create new things too. And so, you know, one of the things that's happening at the time is baseball became an all-consuming thing, you know, and baseball was considered very American. And so a lot of the cultural cues start to come from America, and not just that, but, you know, investment, all this stuff, you know, people, you know, the kind of the founding fathers of America, some of the early politicians of the United States, you know, were always fantasized about getting Cuba someday, you know, and said that someday, you know, that it will be a ripe fruit and it will just fall into our lap. And in 1895, that's more or less the position that Cuba found itself in, because America was exerting so much economic influence and investing so much in the island, and Spain was still struggling to keep some sort of control and tax the heck out of them. So anyway, eventually in 1898, you know, we went to war with Spain. In 1895 is when the Cubans started waging the war for independence. And so that's how we kind of stepped in. And I think, you know, all this stuff starts coming together. And we talked about all the foreign influences, like with cold cuts and stuff. So if, like, for example, you know, one of the earliest loncheros that I found, and a lonchero was the lunch counter man. He basically was responsible for slicing all the meats and the cheeses before there were kind of mechanized things to do this. And they were considered very, they had a very high position in society for what they did, because sandwiches were important. Not only that, but they were posh. You know, these ingredients didn't come cheaply. So the, you know, the hams and all this stuff, a lot of the stuff is being imported from the United States, from Germany, and from England. And so a lot of the earliest sandwiches that I found in Cuba are actually being marketed to foreigners. They were ones who typically had the money and ate all these kind of imported ingredients. So what I think the Cuban sandwich represents is sort of taking what they liked best from this culinary cornucopia, you know, that they inherited from around the world, and putting it in, you know, in a sandwich. And it was pretty revolutionary in the late 1800s to put more than one meat in a sandwich. Mm-hmm. There weren't even many sandwiches that had meat and cheese together. You know, mm-hmm. You'd have a cheese sandwich or you'd have a ham sandwich. This idea of layering 3-4 ingredients and cheese, et cetera, it got a lot of attention. You know, I think Americans were like, wow, you know, the club sandwich had just been invented in like the early 1880s. And so the Cuban sandwich was not far behind. By the end of the 1890s, you know, Cuba is known for really good sandwiches. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, when a bunch of our soldiers went and invaded Cuba to kick out the Spanish, they all went there looking for sandwiches. You know, a lot of them were saying, I'm not leaving that island till I get a Cuban sandwich. And of course, the island had been completely ransacked by years of warfare, scorched earth warfare. So there probably weren't many sandwiches to be found there then. But in the years immediately after the war, as Cuba rebuilt, you know, there were sandwiches just everywhere. And, you know, I should point out, too, that sandwiches were really having a global moment in the...
I was just going to bring that up. There was suddenly this whole, you know, modern... Well, you mentioned baseball, you know, so it was a whole modern era of a sandwich, right?
Right. Yeah, so sandwiches were kind of cutting edge. They've been around for a while, but, you know, by 1900... you start to have much more commercial bakeries opening across the United States. Less and less bread is actually being made at home. More and more sandwiches are being made out and about. You know, already, you know, by mid-century, if you're traveling by rail, there's cheap sandwiches to eat and things like that. But, you know, it also became, sandwiches became a darling of the rich. You know, so the Cuban sandwich is really it was really a novelty and a luxury item, you know, when you have all these different things. And, you know, originally it's known as a mixto. So there, you know, it's not known as a Cuban sandwich in Cuba. It's just a mixed sandwich. You could also see sometimes called surtido, the word, like an assortment. Mm-hmm. And so this could be, you know, almost anything. And a lot of times you would see really wild, you know, strange things, especially the first recipes in English are of the kind of posh variety and very strange. You know, it's like take a thick piece of soft white cheese, you know, lettuce and like salad dressing. And they'd say that it was such a big sandwich, you'd have to eat it with a knife and fork, but it's got three ingredients in it. You know, it just didn't make much sense compared to, I think, what Cubans were actually eating. So, and it's interesting there, too. Like, if you look at Cuban sources and early cookbooks, the sandwiches are all of the posh variety. They're all of, like, the finger food, crustless, unsliced bread variety. Even as late as the 20s, I was just looking at a 1925 cookbook from Havana the other day. And, yeah, they're all, like, caviar-type sandwiches and things. Hmm. So, you know... a working man sandwich, it was kind of considered, not part of that equation. And by the 1920s, the Cuban sandwich had become something that you could buy at several different price points. Right. And so, you know, by the 1950s, somebody is talking about that. If you're a banker, you ate a banker's Cuban sandwich in this neighborhood. If you're a bricklayer, you know, you'd had a different version at a different price point, et cetera, and all up and down the social hierarchy. And, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but, you know, with immigration and kind of the trauma of exile, that changed here in the United States, where Cuban sandwiches had to be cheap. They had to be very affordable for anybody And, you know, it was very difficult for, you know, a Cuban cafe owner to raise prices on, you know, on his fellow people who were coming.
Right. That's a topic we'll get into right after a short break. So stay tuned. There's so much more to talk about and I'm getting hungry. Okay. As usual. Okay. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Andrew Hughes.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Andrew Hughes. And he, along with a couple of his colleagues, have written a new book, and it's called The Cuban Sandwich, A History in Layers. And Andy, you mentioned that, you know, the layer, we were talking about the layers, you know, in between. These layers kind of change or keep getting added to often. But really, I mean, you wrote a lot about the introduction of pork when, you know, when that came along, this really cemented the ideas for the sandwich, I would imagine, you know, the roast pork being what, the lechon,
right?
But the pork that's cooked for the sandwiches, does it always have the same recipe? Does it always that you found? Is it always stewed the same or
no? None of the ingredients are there. I don't think anyone can agree on almost anything. I mean, the yellow mustard is probably the easiest thing to agree upon, but some people mix it with mayonnaise. Some people do other things. But I think the pork is probably one of the most variable. And what's interesting in our research is, you know, depending who you talk to, you get different answers. But I think the old school, the people are of the oldest school, lechon is from the leg. It's from the leg of the pork. And it's important because typically in the old days, you know, you would make a pork roast on the bone and it would be carved by the lonchero off the bone. So that like the ham and the pork both would typically be on the bone. And the lechon, because it's on the leg like that, it can be carved off the bone. It can be sliced thinly and put onto sandwiches. Mm-hmm. So the old school places would have it sliced, kind of like a deli meat, but it's not a processed deli meat. It would be, you know, roast pork that, you know, didn't come out of kind of a factory type condition.
All right. And I mean, and upon first glance, you say, well, it's, you know, okay, it's a ham and pork sandwich with a little melted cheese. But somehow, well, don't forget the pickles, but somehow the combination of that just all, well, and that depends whether it's heated or not heated.
That's another layer, right?
That's another layer. But the taste, it just all melds together. And I can see where, you know, if you were someone living in exile, that a bite of that would just, you know, make you swoon with memories of, you know, of home.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about that, another layer, and that's the heating. You know, like, so now we have paninos that are always put in the sandwich press, and, you know, it's more of a common thing. But this has been going on for some time with the Cubans.
Well, and also just to finish up on the pork really quick, you know, a lot of people today, they might use pork loin because it's lean, but that's not really, that's kind of wrongheaded. So there's a lot of different ways. But yeah, as far as we could tell, the lechon was the kind of the foundational thing. Mm. Now, what were we jumping to next?
Yeah, you need, because you need that fat. You need that fat right. to bring it all together, right? Oh, the whole thing
The heating, right.
The heating and the bread. I mean, the bread is the thing. It's always the thing in a sandwich, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the bread's really important. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, Tampa and Miami have different generations of bakers as well. Their bakers take cues from different generations. And there's really one in particular here in Tampa that stands out, La Segunda Central. And they, you know, they make some of the best Cuban bread anywhere, especially of the old school. So the older school Cuban bread is crustier. You know, it's not a mass produced item. So, you know, what happened is, between the 1890s, sort of where we got our recipe from, or around the turn of the century, and the mid-1950s, where a lot of Miami's bakers took their cues from, baking in Cuba itself changed. So it was influenced a lot by the United States and a lot of the mass production techniques done here, to where you'd have, you know, you might have a dozen loaves of bread on a single pan, for example, or 20. Whereas in, you know, La Segunda, there's several extra steps that they would take. So one of those is, while the bread is proofing, they would, they put it on racks in front of the ovens, and they open the ovens and let the warm air kind of wash over. They have fans that are blowing on the bread and
kind of dry it out before they bake it. Yeah,
exactly. And that's how you get that, like paper thin crusty layer, mm-hmm. and then the interior is still really nice and soft and kind of airy. So that's that, and also when they put it in the oven, they put the loaves directly into the hearth, so it's directly on the hot brick, etc., and it's really instrumental for getting that kind of shattering thin crust.
Now, does Segundo, are they the ones that use the palmetto leaves on top?
Correct. Yeah. So that goes back to Cuba as well. And take a thin slice of palmetto leaf. And it's really a signature for them and for a few other bakeries who still do it. There's been a lot of debate about why that was there. And the best that I could tell is a couple colleagues and I have been kind of discussing it, and one of them in particular, John O. Miller, he wrote a whole book about
palmetto.
And it's best we could tell, it's sort of like a thermometer, or it's a gauge for when there's too much heat. So if you start to see the palmetto leaves, you know, starting to singe a little bit, then, that means you probably need to rotate your bread or shift it around, because, mm-hmm. you know, originally this is all done in wood burning ovens, and you could have really hot spots and cooler spots, especially because a lot of the early ovens were made by hand here in Tampa. Might've been put together rather quickly at first. So,
This is the pan de agua that Segundo makes, right?
Right. So,
and water bread, right?
Flour, yeah, exactly. Water. It doesn't really have any fat in it per se. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why it just has such a short shelf life. You know, typically, like really good Cuban bread, it's got about maybe 24 hours, you know, if that. I mean, in the old days, it would go stale more or less by the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a couple interesting things around that. So, first of all, it sort of begs the question, if the pressing came about to give Miami sandwiches more of a toasted, type of feel, whereas Tampa was already kind of crusty. But the thing is, what's interesting is in Tampa, they were already heating up their sandwiches. I read about as early as the 1940s, like the Columbia has a special warming oven, the Columbia restaurant, to put sandwiches in. And then other people were using tailor's iron. So like a heavy.
I loved that.
Right. And you would put it in a skillet and then put the tailor's iron, hot tailor's iron on top. And that would press it.
Yeah. Cause I was figuring, wait a minute, they didn't have, you know, these electric sandwich presses then. I mean,
right. Well, what's interesting too, is I found an ad for a sandwich press in the Cuban newspaper in the 1920s. So
just put it on the stove and heat it up. Right.
Yeah. And they were none of these electric, you could plug them in. You know, it was very newfangled technology at the time, but they did exist. It didn't become a universal thing until, yeah, really Miami is the one, you know, who really institutionalized the pressing, you know, right. For a lot of people, you just can't have it not pressed. And it is amazing what it does to the sandwich, you know, to what could already be a really good sandwich, or what could take, you know, you can take a mediocre sandwich and make it even more than passable.
Right. So. Right. I would be remiss. We're talking about the bread of Tampa and all, but if we didn't talk about the group of people who really popularized the sandwich quite a bit, and those were the cigar workers.
Right.
Now, they were primarily in, everywhere. I mean, Key West and Miami and
New York, certainly.
In Tampa and New York, right. But give us a little background on that.
Yeah, so cigars were a hugely important industry. You know, sugar was, of course, probably the original, you know, big industry out of Cuba. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, really associated with slavery, whereas tobacco was kind of considered more of a noble pursuit. You know, it didn't depend on slave labor, and it depended on a lot of skilled labor. And these skilled cigar workers became the backbone of the workforce for cigar factories. And, you know, originally this was in Havana and other parts of Cuba, but over time there was so much instability in Cuba that more and more factories started to relocate to the United States. So originally a lot of these came to Key West. Some came to New York. And then a lot of them left Key West and came up to Tampa, Florida. And so that's how Key West and Tampa got such, early, you know, Cuban communities, because these were skilled workers, and, you know, it would take years to learn to do the jobs they did. So it simply wasn't possible just to draft a bunch of, you know, people who are here in Tampa. You know, you had to have those cigar workers, and they were really almost all Cuban. You know, later there was a lot more Spanish who joined the cigar workforces, and there were some of those in Havana as well. And then later Sicilians became a really important part of the workforce here as well. But Cuba, you know, the Cubans were the ones who really called the cultural shots, you know, in a big way. So Ybor City here in Tampa was made to just be a virtual replica of Havana. So everything from, you know, the food, the cigars, the coffee, and the lampposts, you know, everything was meant to, you know, the architecture. So, you know, I find that really interesting. You know, the thing that I find the most challenging was Key West, just because there are so few written sources to work with that it's very difficult to tell, you know, if the sandwich was popular there at the time, or if there were sandwiches, what, you know, what was in them. So that's difficult. So I know that there's probably more of a role there, and I'd be surprised if there wasn't some sort of proto sandwich. I'm not sure if it was the mixto yet, but it would be really interesting to see what it was. So.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was interesting too, that these cigar workers would often break several times, you know, for a little coffee break and a sandwich break. But the sandwiches would be like we consider little tea sandwiches, right? Little.
Yeah, much smaller.
3x3 squares or something very, you know, a little more delicate. Because it was just a snack,
Yeah, well, and they would be on Cuban bread, so it wouldn't be a square sandwich exactly, but it would be, first of all, the Cuban bread, the girth was a lot less than it was now. I mean, when they talked about Cuban bread in like the 1900s in Havana itself, people said it was about this, you know, the width, it was about as big around as a silver dollar. Huh. So, I mean, that's a pretty small loaf of bread.
Yeah, so a little, a coin-sized sandwich, yes.
Right, so you'd have, you know, you'd have pretty small sandwiches, I think, back then. And, you know, and a lot of this, you got to think, too, it was very popular at night. You know, we the Medianoche, you know, is one that you can't not talk about. It's basically very similar to a mixto or a Cuban sandwich, but it's served on different bread, served on an egg bread that's closer to like a challah bread. And you know, one of the reasons for that is because, you know, my guess is that all the Cuban bread that was made that morning was all stale by midnight.
Or gone.
Yeah. And it was also considered, it was a little bit of a sweeter bread. So it was just considered like even more of a treat, you know.
Midnight snack, a medianoche, right?
Right, something to eat after. And, you know, like I said, these aren't giant sandwiches. People are eating them after theater and before going to bed. So, you know, I just don't think that the sandwiches back then were huge, yeah, like you see in some places now, you know.
Well, there is just so much information packed into this book, and you are giving us so many wonderful stories from your research. And I mean, as the book kind of closes up with, you say, the devil is in the details, and trying to find out which version is authentic, what's, you know, what the origins. The devil is in the details, and that you have told us. You have given us such an example of that. Because the sandwich, as you've written, is not composed of a handful of ingredients, but a series of recipes constructed from a whole. There's a sense of place to consider, that immeasurable, intangible sense of authenticity when your experience, in this case, a sandwich, resonates with the places and the people around you. And I just think that it just illustrates so much how you how you have all said in your title, a history in layers. And certainly you've given us a little bird's eye view into the what's between those layers. And thank you so much. It's just been a pleasure to talk to you. And I encourage people to take a look at this book if you love a Cuban sandwich or if you want to know more about Cuban food history. And that's The Cuban Sandwich, A History in Layers. And my guest has been Andrew Hughes, curator and archivist of Florida Studies at University of South Florida Libraries. Andy, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Linda.
And thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.